right, I'm very pleased to welcome to the show my guest, Gareth Porter. Gareth is an independent investigative journalist and historian writing on U.S. national security policy and military policy, and his latest book is Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare, and it was put out by Just World Books. Gareth, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Michael. Glad to be on.
Yeah. Well, this comes at a time when it seems everybody and everything, it seems like there's never a time in the year that something in relation to Iran is not showing up and turning into a crisis one way or the other. You know, your book was really an eye-opener for a lot of people, myself included, in terms of the, you know, what's going on there. And so you titled it Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. Can you talk with me a little bit about this? What is this issue of Iran possessing nuclear weapons or even the potential to produce them has been out there, like I was saying, in such a big way for quite some time, but so few people would actually know, I think, automatically is what you're referring to when you say a manufactured crisis. So what was the crisis and what's it mean that it was manufactured?
Well, the crisis, as I have defined it, is what began to happen in the George W. Bush administration around 2003, 2004, when the United States was leading the charge internationally and the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, was investigating Iran. But behind them was a coalition led again by the United States, by the Bush administration, which was essentially already charging that Iran had a covert nuclear weapons program, and that charge then suddenly, you know, took shape in the form of a set of documents, which mysteriously appeared in 2004. We began to read about them in 2005, 2006, 2007, leaked to the media, that these documents were from within this alleged covert Iranian nuclear weapons program. Well, you know, it turns out, of course, as I talk about in my book at some length, that these documents are they could not be authentic. There are too many things about them that are not just suspicious, but downright, you know, supportive of the conclusion that they were in fact fabricated. So that is the heart of the crisis. From then on, the Iranians were not just accused of having a covert nuclear weapons program, but they were punished in a series of measures before the United Nations Security Council, which demanded that they stop, they cease all enrichment activities. And then, of course, came the beginning of the harsh economic sanctions, which prevented Iran from essentially selling oil to its regular customers, and so that's the crisis that I discuss in the book, and the book is really all about how that was indeed manufactured. It was the result of a very deliberate policy on the part of the Bush administration and working very closely with the Israelis to create this idea that Iran, you know, had, in fact, had a nuclear weapons program that it was hiding.
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting what you've been saying about this crisis. And I was wondering about this because, you know, it seems like this idea of Iran and nuclear weapons and nuclear threat has been running through this from almost the very beginning of the Islamic regime in Iran. And in fact, you trace this crisis, you break this crisis up into almost a sort of an overall crisis, and you break it up into like three stages. Can we talk about them, the stages?
Yeah, so what you're talking about is the pre-crisis stage, if you will, which really begins in the 1980s, very soon, as you say, after the Islamic Republic was formed. The Reagan administration, which at that point was clearly supporting the Iraqi war against Iran, you know, started by Saddam Hussein in 1981 or late 1980. And as part of that overall anti-Iran policy and pro-Iraq policy, the Reagan administration actually tried to strangle the extremely nascent Iranian, the Islamic Republic's nuclear program in the cradle, as it were, by essentially ordering its allies, particularly the French and the Germans, not to cooperate at all with Iran's nuclear program. And that meant that the initial plan, which Iran had enunciated in 1981-82, that it would rely on a French-based consortium, a multinational consortium, to do the enrichment for nuclear fuel for this one remaining or the only really nuclear power plant that Iran had ever built under the Shah, of course, because they couldn't get the enriched uranium for the fuel from this consortium, they had a choice. They could either bow down to the American will, which was you are not to have a nuclear program at all, a peaceful nuclear program, or they could get the independent means to enrich uranium themselves. And of course, being Iranians and very proud, they chose the latter course. And that was the beginning of the interaction between Iran's trying to get the ability, the capability to enrich uranium, and the constant pressure from the United States, in some cases supported by allies, in other cases really not supported by them, to force the Iranians to cease and desist.
Now, tell me if I'm wrong here, but as I understood it, there is no problem, according to any international law or any international court or dictum, there's no problem with countries actually having nuclear power per se, right?
Well, it's not only not a problem, but indeed the point that I would have made had I continued that account is that when the United States tried to force the Iranians to give up their nuclear power program by essentially putting pressure on U.S. allies not to cooperate with Iran, it was violating the Non-Proliferation Treaty, because that treaty guarantees all signatories who are in good standing with the treaty, in other words, who are not violating it by trying to have a nuclear weapons program to procure nuclear weapons, to make nuclear weapons. And Iran at that point clearly was not in violation, and the United States didn't even claim that it was in violation of the NPT. So to try to prevent the Iranians from having a nuclear program at that point was an outright central violation of the NPT, and the Iranians were quite correct in their accusation of the United States as trying to deprive them of their absolute right under international law.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Gareth Porter. Gareth is an independent investigative journalist, and his latest book is Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. Now, tell me this. You talk about this as being a manufactured crisis, all right? And we've just talked about why you said that. But I'm kind of wondering what, you know, when we talk about it being manufactured, it actually conjures up the idea that there's, you know, Santa's elves in the back room hammering it all together. But there's actually a whole thing going on of concerted and conscious effort to paint Iran into a corner in a certain sense, and to actually, you know, hit at it from every angle, as you're pointing out, in terms of these different stages. And I was wondering if you could talk about how did this actually play out. I mean, there were different forces involved, and one was the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, which seems to have played a critical role and a partisan role at the same time.
Absolutely, and this is part of the tragedy, if you will, of this entire story. Because at the outset of this crisis, as I've defined it, beginning in 2003-2004 period, the IAEA, under Mohammad El-Baradei, the director general of the organization, was an independent figure who had actually stood up to the Bush administration on its fraudulent claims of documentation about the Nigergate affair, the letters that were supposedly showing that Iraq had gone to Niger to get uranium for a bomb, which turned out to be a fabrication. Well, you know, the IAEA actually played the key role in uncovering that fabrication. The CIA never somehow was able to discover it, and the IAEA found it out within a few hours of beginning its research. So that simply underlines the fact that it was indeed an independent, international, neutral agency as of the time that this process began in 2003-2004. But as I document in the book, what happened then was in 2008 and 2009, the director general essentially pulled back. That is, El-Baradei pulled back, no longer really called the shots in terms of the attitude of the organization toward these documents that I alluded to earlier, the laptop documents, they called them, or the alleged studies, as they were called officially by the IAEA. El-Baradei had actually said that we cannot say that these documents are evidence against Iran because they have not been authenticated. He said this publicly more than once. And he insisted that the IAEA could not use that as evidence that, that Iran was, in fact, violating its obligations. And then in 2008, Al-Baradei began to step back, and Olli Heinonen, who was the head of the Safeguards Department, a deputy director general of IAEA, stepped in and became the primary force really determining the position of the IAEA on the question of whether Iran had, in fact, done what was suggested in these documents. And Heinonen was working very closely with the Bush administration. We can see that from some of the documents that were released by the WikiLeaks, in the WikiLeaks cables, that he went along with an idea that showed the idea was to claim that Iran had actually admitted that some of the documentation, some of the things in the documentation were accurate, but that it was really only about non-nuclear applications. Well, that was a complete and utter lie because the Iranians never admitted to anything like that. All they admitted to was that certain names, places, and organizations actually existed, but they never admitted that any of the activities that were depicted actually took place. So that was a central lie that Olli Heinonen put into his reports, the IAEA reports in 2008, and at the same time, he was making the argument in the reports that these documents are credible and we should use them as the basis for our investigation. So that was really the key turning point. Mm-hmm. And from then on, and it's still true, absolutely true today, the IAEA has been playing a partisan role on behalf of U.S. policy in accusing the Iranians of having had a covert nuclear weapons program, despite the fact that those documents are just as suspect today as they ever were when Al-Baradei was saying so publicly.
Now, I want to pursue that a little bit more because you mentioned a couple of things, the WikiLeaks documents. You also mentioned the laptop documents.
Yes.
And I'd like to talk about them a little bit.
Right. The laptop documents are documents that surfaced in 2004 mysteriously. The CIA got them, we now know, from German intelligence, from the BND, German Foreign Intelligence Agency. The Bush administration leaked stuff to the news media but never really talked about them, and it created a kind of myth surrounding these documents that they had come from an Iranian engineer or scientist who was actually a participant in the alleged program that they supposedly depict. And in fact, information that has come out since then, and I document it in my book, shows that those documents did not come from an Iranian who was involved in any such program. They came from the Mujahideen-e-Khalq, the MEK, the organization that had been on the terrorist list and which we know, it's very well documented, during that period, 2003-2004, they were working very closely with Israeli intelligence, laundering, as the term is used normally, laundering intelligence that the Israelis wanted to get out to the public, or alleged intelligence they wanted to get to the public, but did not want to have associated directly with Israel. So the MEK delivers these documents to German intelligence. They get them to the United States, and then that's the route that they took in order to sort of infect the public consideration of this whole issue of the Iranian nuclear program. And what I do in my book is to point out that there are numerous indications that these documents were fraudulent. And I point to a couple of central contradictions between material that's found in the documents and actual timelines, objective timelines that you can get from independent official documentation. One of them is the fact that the missile warhead or reentry vehicle of the missile that was shown in the key documents, supposedly depicting an effort to integrate a nuclear weapon into the Shahab-3 missile of Iran. It was the wrong. It was the wrong missile. It was the wrong reentry vehicle. It was the wrong shape. It didn't reflect what we now know was, in fact, the vehicle that was being designed by the Iranians at the time these documents were supposedly being produced. And I confronted Oli Heinonen of the IAEA, or formerly of the IAEA, when he was at Harvard University a couple of 3 years ago, about this. He did not provide any explanation for this that made any sense. The other contradiction just had to do with the timeline of the Iranian nuclear program. There's a part of the alleged program that was supposedly a project that had to do with the milling of uranium. And it turns out that that project actually was started by the civilian nuclear program of Iran 2 years before the start of this supposed covert nuclear weapons program. So it's clear that somebody was taking an actual documentary fact and trying to work it into this alleged nuclear weapons program, and didn't expect that this was going that the contradiction would surface, but, mm-hmm. it has.
Mm-hmm. Now, Gareth, as you're talking, I kept thinking, you know, you mentioned once in there the role of Israel, and I wanted to hit at that too, because it seemed like Israel has played a big role in all this along with the U.S. And I wanted to talk a little bit about what you can tell us about the Israeli role in all of this.
Well, the Israeli role is absolutely central, and I hadn't gotten to that point yet, but that was the next thing that I was going to talk about, because the laptop documents, or the alleged studies documents, were clearly from Israel, and this can be documented, first of all, because the MEK was so closely working with Mossad that it didn't do anything like this without getting its information from Mossad. It was incapable of manufacturing these documents, of fabricating these documents. And Mossad, in fact, we know, second key point, had an office that was responsible for essentially influencing global political opinion on the Iranian nuclear program. This is a fact that was documented by a book by two American journalists who had they were convinced that Iran did have a covert nuclear weapons program. So they were revealing this without understanding its significance. That's the second point. The third point is that we know that there's a popular book on the covert operations of Mossad, the greatest operations of Mossad, which was a bestseller in Israel. It was published in Hebrew in 2010, as I recall. And in that book, the author, who was a former member of the Israeli Knesset and a former paratrooper, obviously strongly supportive of Mossad's operations, reveals that, in fact, the MEK had been used by Israel to get information out, that the MEK was pretty much of a non-entity in terms of coming up with intelligence itself, and that, it was, in fact, being fed stuff by the Israelis, including the laptop documents. So, this is part of the documentation that I rely upon to make the case that that these documents did in fact come from the Mossad. There's also a connection between John Bolton and the Mossad, which is very important. We know for a fact that Bolton took unauthorized trips to Israel in 2003 and 2004, and that at least on one of those trips, and perhaps both of them, he had a meeting with the head of Mossad. A meeting, of course, for which there was no record of any kind, so he was free to discuss this kind of thing with the head of Mossad. And we know that Bolton himself, in 2004, was beginning to carry out a kind of disinformation campaign based on supposed photographs from satellite photographs showing Parchin military base. and with the claim that what the pictures showed was a place or places where the Iranians could have carried out experiments, high explosive experiments that could be used to test nuclear weapons. Well, that was one of the themes in these laptop documents. It was one of the things that the laptop documents were going to show. So there is a congruence here between what John Bolton was starting to do in 2004 and the documents that were being released at that very moment in mid-2004, secretly being released, given to the MEK and then to the Germans to be gotten to the United States government.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Gareth Porter. Gareth is an independent investigative journalist and historian writing on U.S. national security policy. And his latest book is Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. When you mentioned John Bolton, one of the things that really immediately popped into my head was Robert Gates. One of the things that struck me in going through your book is Robert Gates actually, from the very beginning of this whole scenario, all the way up until most recently, he actually did play a role in the maneuvering around the question of Iran.
Absolutely, and that's a very important part of the story, which I haven't mentioned at all, and I'm glad you've raised it, because it goes to the key point here of the motivation behind the continued U.S. policy of enmity toward Iran, the policy of making Iran a high-profile major enemy, if not the primary enemy of the United States, after the Cold War. Well, there's a connection between the end of the Cold War and that policy, and that's what I document in the book. I show that Robert M. Gates became the director of the Central Intelligence Agency just on the eve of the collapse of the Soviet Union. It was in November 1991 that he became the director of CIA, and it was, of course, a few months later that the Soviet Union ceased to exist. And, of course, even before that, Gates knew that his primary problem as head of the CIA was that they no longer had the Soviet Union to use to try to get Congress to give the agency Cold War levels of appropriations. And so he was desperate when he became the director of the CIA to find a substitute for the Soviet threat. And he found that substitute in a combination of the threat of proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, and of course primarily nuclear weapons, and Iran. And I show in the book that he hammered away at these two themes, the danger of proliferation of nuclear weapons and the threat of Iran to the Middle East and to the world because of its rearming itself in general and its what he claimed was an effort to get the capability to have a nuclear weapon. So Gates was indeed instrumental in setting the framework in which the United States would accuse Iran of wanting nuclear weapons. It started with Robert M. Gates. He was the first one to make that case. He used it very actively to try to get Congress to keep very high levels of congressional appropriations for the agency. He was relatively successful in that. And the Pentagon did the same thing, although not as intensively. They didn't rely as heavily on the Iran threat because they have, they have other problems as well. But the national security state in general, after the fall of the Soviet Union, turned to Iran as the next big thing, and that has that fact has dominated the U.S. policy toward Iran ever since then. I think that Israel has played a very important role in influencing U.S. policy along the way, but I have to say that the most fundamental basis for the enmity that the United States government has shown toward Iran, particularly since the end of the Cold War, has been that Iran was a valuable enemy, an enemy that we needed in order to maintain the status quo in terms of, not having the system fall apart because there was no sense of threat.
What do you think Iran's actual nuclear policy is? And I'm asking you that because I read something in your book that was kind of stunning. I didn't know it. First of all, they started building the nuclear reactors under the Shah. That stopped when the Shah was overthrown. But the Islamic regime actually has a policy against nuclear weapons and chemical weapons. And so it doesn't fit if you're thinking about, okay, really they're out there and they're aiming to build nuclear reactors so they can have nuclear weapons. What do you think the policy actually is?
Right. You've pinpointed, I think, a crucial aspect of Iranian policy, which is so little known that it's really tragic. And that is that because of Iran's peculiar theology, which is Shia Islam, there is a very strong theological prohibition against weapons of mass destruction. And that prohibition is in fact based on Quranic injunctions, things that are found in the Quran, as well as commentaries on the Quran. When I was in Iran last year, I heard a lot about this because, you know, the Ayatollahs talk about it all the time, that traditionally the idea of that it was wrong, that it was illegal under Islam to poison the wells of your adversary was the basis for Ayatollah Khomeini, the first supreme leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, to say publicly, as well as in government meetings, that Iran could not possess chemical weapons, even during the Iran-Iraq War, when Iran was being attacked by Saddam's forces with chemical weapons over and over and over again. And as many as 100,000 Iranians were hurt. They were seriously affected by the chemical weapons attacks. And I interviewed this was not in my book because this happened after the book was published. I interviewed the wartime, that is the Iran-Iraq War, period minister of SEPA, meaning the minister who was in charge of logistics for the war. And he told me about two different meetings that he had with Khomeini during the war, meetings in which he tried to get Khomeini to agree to go along with preparations for both chemical weapons and nuclear weapons, because you know, the lay people who were working on the war believed that was what Iran was going to need to do in order to be able to ultimately defeat the Iraqis, to have a deterrent. And he said, to make a long story short, that in both cases, in both meetings, even after Iranian civilians were being killed and maimed by chemical weapons by the Iraqis, Ayatollah Khomeini refused to allow any work at all on chemical weapons, let alone nuclear weapons. He said, nuclear weapons, don't even think about it. That's not on. And he forbade them from doing anything to produce chemical weapons either. So during that war, the basic policy was established by Khomeini on the basis of Shia Islamic theology and jurisprudence, as they call it. And that policy was then continued by the present supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, and he's articulated it repeatedly. He's put out a fatwa, as the Iranians call it, forbidding work on weapons of mass destruction of any kind, and of course, particularly against nuclear weapons. So I think it's very difficult for Westerners who have no ethical or religious compunction about weapons of mass destruction to imagine that a country that has been so despised by the West could possibly have a higher standard of ethics than we do. But that isn't indeed a fact.
Mm-hmm. And, all right, you've laid out a pretty strong basis, Gareth, for this whole idea of there's no basis in reality for sort of the campaign that the U.S. and Israel have been waging against Iran in terms of this nuclear scare. But there was something that has pushed this out big. And I wanted to talk about this because it's very important, because it's a lot of the ways that opinion gets shaped. The press in this country has been sort of falling all over themselves to just follow whatever the U.S. says in relation to the nuclear policies of Iran. And they have actually been played a key role in this, in developing this crisis.
Well, that's absolutely right. This is a theme that is woven into the story that I tell in the book. I don't have a chapter set aside on the media coverage, but over and over again, what I found in looking at various episodes that were crucial in the evolution of the crisis, the coverage by the news media invariably took two or three forms. One of them was, as you said, to just repeat the official line of the United States and the Israelis about Iranian policy without any fact-checking, without any investigation or skepticism. But beyond that, there's another pattern that I found which was particularly troubling, and that is that the IAEA reports, or the investigation of the IAEA in general, spawned a whole series of episodes in which the Americans, presumably, in most cases at least, were leaking their version of what the IAEA had found or what was going to be in a report by the IAEA to the New York Times or to the British media. And the stories that came out were completely distorted, and one could document that on the basis of the totality of information that finally came out. But there was a pattern there of generating stories that were highly skewed and highly inaccurate about what the IAEA had found in their investigation and or reported. And then there was another episode that I found particularly outrageous, which also had to do with the IAEA report. It was the report of November 2003. That was a report when the IAEA was quite critical of Iran because it had not reported activities that it had carried out. And this had to do with the Iranian. It's a bit complicated. I won't go into the details, but the Iranians had their own reasons for feeling that if they reported their activities to the IAEA, the Chinese who had sold them uranium would be forced to stop their cooperation with Iran, and so they kept it secret. But the report also, this 2003 report, also said that there was no evidence that Iran actually had a nuclear weapons program. And the worst coverage of that report was from National Public Radio. Their coverage was, it could have been scripted by John Bolton. I mean, he could have written the story himself, and it would have been exactly what the NPR reported. Their coverage was so slanted in the direction of the neoconservative viewpoint of the George W. Bush administration. And so that was a particularly troubling case of the news media essentially carrying the water of the George W. Bush administration, or more precisely, the neoconservatives within the administration, because this was representing their viewpoint.
Mm-hmm. All right, Gareth Porter, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks so much, Michael.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Gareth Porter. Gareth is an independent investigative journalist and historian writing on U.S. national security policy. His latest book is Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back to talk with our next guest, Sansara Taylor from StopPatriarchy.org. And we're going to talk with Sansara about International Women's Day and the fight against the degradation and enslavement of women everywhere. So stay tuned. All right, welcome back. That was Leslie Gore with You Don't Own Me. And I played that one in honor of Leslie Gore, who just died recently, and also because it's so damn appropriate to what we're talking about today. I'm very happy to welcome back to the show my guest, Sansara Taylor. Sansara is a frequent guest on the show. She is also one of the founders of End Pornography and Patriarchy, The Enslavement and Degradation of Women. And you can read all about that by going to stoppatriarchy.org. Sansara also writes for Revolution Newspaper, and you can find out all about that by going to revcom.us. Sansara, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. I'm glad to be with you.
Yeah, it's a very heavy time to be talking with you. All kinds of stuff is going on, and we're coming right up on International Women's Day, a very important day. And I wanted to start the show with that, you know, talking with you about International Women's Day this year, why it's important, what it's about. Just run with it.
Yeah, so International Women's Day, it's March 8th, and it's, like you said, international. It's all over the world, and it is a revolutionary holiday to both mobilize everybody to confront the violence, the degradation, the humiliation, and the oppression that women face on every corner of this globe, whether it's rape and brutality and abuse at the hands of soldiers, law enforcement, fathers, brothers, even those who are supposed to be their most intimate lovers, or the stigma that is preached and the shame that is preached out of Dark Ages scripture, out of every major religion, and especially the fundamentalist varieties of them in every corner of the world against women, and telling them that they should obey their husbands, that they shouldn't have sex, the women who are stripped naked and sold as sex slaves, the women who are shrouded and imprisoned in veils and burqas around the world, the women who lose their lives for lack of safe abortion. All over the world, women face excruciating oppression, and this is something that everybody who hates injustice needs to stand up and fight against. That's a big part of International Women's Day. The other dimension is to really celebrate and unleash the fury and the role of women as a mighty force for revolution, and to recognize the incredibly emancipatory role that women standing up, women unleashing that anger, and men standing with them against this oppression can play in advancing the struggle to make an actual revolution, a revolution that can emancipate all of humanity.
Yeah, you know, and it couldn't be coming at a more appropriate point in what's going on in the world. I mean, I was thinking about it the other day, and it's just so glaringly horrendous when you think about things like the stuff that's come out, all the pornography that's been up in the air and out in society, all the kinds of things that have been going on around rape. And I was up at Sundance and I saw this film by Kirby Dick, The Hunting Ground, and it was just amazing and incredible, the kinds of assault that's coming up against women from every direction. It just seems like overwhelming these days.
Yeah, in this society, and frankly around the world, this is a point that Bob Avakian has pointed out very powerfully in his talk, Revolution, Nothing Less. He says, look, you can do to women in this society, and it is socially acceptable or accepted in any case by so many people, you can do to women what you cannot do to any other section of society. The level of open, vile hatred, abuse, cruelty, humiliation, threat, and propaganda of that, including, like you're saying, the more and more violent and degrading pornography that's more and more mainstream. And this is just pervasive, and it's so rampant that people have learned to accept it in a lot of ways. They learn to just live with it, and they don't even notice how vicious so much of the culture is. And so International Women's Day is a really important day for people to stand up and say, no, we're sick of being bombarded every step of our lives, every billboard, every time you turn on your internet, every time you go to the drugstore because you have a cold, you want to buy some cough medicine, and you get these magazines staring at you that display women as objects to be used for the sexual plunder of men, that train men to think women are there to serve them, and that train women that their value is reducible to their sexual attractiveness or their ability to have a child rather than their full humanity. And this is something that is not human nature. It is the nature of the capitalist, imperialist, patriarchal system we live under. And we can fight and we can change it, but that does require standing up and struggling against it and coming out in public and denouncing it and unleashing a culture of liberation and mutual respect and equality for women, for gays, lesbians, transgender people who do not conform to the dominant patriarchal, I hate to call them norms, but the unwritten laws of the way the society is supposed to function, and to stand up against that and to forge a community of resistance and opposition to this culture as part of fighting to actually build up the strength to make a revolution that can tear the whole framework down and build a liberated world.
You know, in that film, The Hunting Ground, one of the things that really slapped me back in my seat was at the end when it ran that statistic. Each year, 100,000 young women will be assaulted on college campuses throughout the country.
That's right. It's like clockwork in this society. It just goes on. It goes on every day. 100,000 women was their estimate of how many people will be, women will be raped or sexually assaulted on campus this year and next year and the year after. I believe 3 or 4 women are murdered by their so-called partners every single day in this society. And it's so routine, it does not make the news. It's so routine, it's just the way it is. And it's nothing that we should accept. It's not permanent. It doesn't have to stay this way. I can't say it enough times. We're told that this is just the way it is. Boys will be boys, and, you know, women, this is what you have to navigate. But it's not. It doesn't have to be this way. We don't have to accept it, but we do have to challenge it, and we have to wake other people up to it, because it's intolerable what happens on the campuses. And of course, it's not unique to the campuses, the level of sexual violence. You could look at the churches, you could look at the neighborhoods, you can go into the projects, you can go into the most elite suburbs and high rises. You could go anywhere in this society, and frankly, anywhere in the world right now, and find grotesque, pervasive, systematic, predictable violence against women and humiliation of women. And that has to change.
Yeah, and exactly what you're saying about it being so normalized is something I want to get into in a minute. But I want to remind people that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sansara Taylor, a writer for Revolution Newspaper and from StopPatriarchy.org. Now, Sansara, let's talk about this normalization thing, because it is incredible the amount of things that have just been so normalized. You know, it's even, I saw this little kid standing out in the street the other day, and he was like sort of catcalling at women. And the kid couldn't have been more than 6 years old. And he was just standing out there catcalling and talking about what they look like. And I kept thinking about the kind of society, the kind of culture that we live in that permits this, that actually not just permits it, but encourages this kind of view towards women from the earliest ages in guys and women themselves. Can we talk about that a little? Because that normalization and the whole way the society just pumps it out is very, very repulsive.
Well, you know, I think it's really important when you observe something like that from a child that you have to say, this is not the kid's fault. They're, you know, children are like little sponges. They soak up the messages and the attitudes and the morals and the relations and dominant views of society that they're surrounded by. And I think that when you have, I could think of a many, many, many examples of similar things to what you just described. I think that is a challenge. A lot of people will say, oh, look, it's a kid. It's human nature. That's the way kids are. But no, kids are a reflection. Their attitudes reflect the training they get in society. And so, you know, this is one of the reasons it needs to be socially challenged by a massive movement and, yes, by a revolution, because I know many people who reject a lot of the hatred that's spewed towards women. They want to shelter their daughters from it. They want to shelter their sons from it. They want to raise their children to have better attitudes towards women. But the kids get the message from the broader society one way or the other. And I think of the situation in Richmond, California, a few years ago, where there was a 15-year-old girl at her homecoming dance. And some boys from her class lured her outside, and they proceeded to gang rape her, to brutalize her so viciously that when it was all over, she was unconscious, left lying amongst the garbage under a bench behind the school. But the worst part about it was that all these kids, you know how it is, you're in school and something's going on, there's a fight, there's a commotion, there's something dramatic. All the kids, you know, they started to hear about it inside the dance, and they're coming out more and more and more of them, and the crowd is gathering. And a bigger and bigger crowd of other kids gathers, male and female, and not a single one told a teacher or an administrator or a chaperone or anybody adult at that dance what was going on. But quite a few of them took out their cell phones and started filming it and taking pictures of it and posting it on social media. And I'll say this, you can't blame a bunch of kids. Yes, you should hold them accountable if they commit these acts, but you can't blame them. They didn't create this culture. And you do have one of the big things that's shaping kids right now is the rampant exposure to pornography, which is, like I said, more and more violent, more and more cruel, more and more humiliating and degrading towards women, and just filled with revenge against women, cruelty against women. And yet it's more and more available, more and more pervasive, and there's less and less, and this is also has to do with the oppression of women, less and less real sex education, less and less, you know, more and more repression coming from the church and then violence coming from porn, that the average age of a boy to start watching porn or encountered on the web is 11. So their very, very formative coming of age of awakening of sexuality is coupled with the eroticization of dehumanizing cruelty against women. And so they are trained and they learn to think that this is normal, this is natural. And in fact, when you see this, hey, you should take a video. That's what goes on videos. And so this is something, again, it can't be changed one person by one person. It has to actually be fought against. As a society-wide culture, there has to be a different pole planted that says, stop watching porn. Stop shaming women. Stand up for women's right to abortion. Stand up for women's right to birth control. Stand up for women's right to determine the course of their lives freely and fully, and to contribute and participate together with men in the struggle to actually win full liberation and full emancipation, which is going to take really tearing up this system from its roots and building a whole new society and structure. It's going to take a revolution. And so this is something that I keep coming back. You keep asking me about the culture and the pervasiveness, and it's important to talk about it, but it's important to keep coming back to the fact that it doesn't have to be this way, and there's ways and a responsibility everybody has to be part of fighting against this, even as we're learning more about it.
I want to talk about that in just a few minutes as we move towards a close on this, but I have a couple more things to talk with you about. One is, you were recently involved in, since we're talking about porn at the moment, you were recently involved in a whole campaign against this film, 50 Shades of Grey, which I thought was like really great that you were standing up against this and calling it out. But it's interesting, you know, the kinds of responses you got, both good and bad. And I've talked to a lot of people around that I know who had these kinds of responses of like, look, man, it's just porn. It's just sex. And it's just like, you know, people are just, who are you to tell anybody what they should watch or what they should enjoy?
Well, I think, you know, it is true. 50 Shades of Grey it's just a romanticization of an abusive relationship, a sexually and emotionally abusive relationship towards the woman by a man who stalks her, who basically, you know, manipulates and traumatizes her, alternately flatters her, and just decimates her emotionally, and then physically takes her way outside of her comfort zone and does things which by any definition would constitute abuse. It ends with a scene where he whips her with a belt. You know, she's naked and he's got a belt, and he does it with the full force of his strength, and she's sobbing, and he's making her count how many times he whips her. And so this is not a love story. This is a story of abuse, and it's being romanticized. And the danger of it is it's being sold. And it's a big leap in mainstreaming violent degradation of women and selling it as a fantasy to women and normalizing that. Rather than saying, hey, these are the signs of abuse. A man stalks you, he shows up without your permission in your space, he takes off your clothes while you're unconscious, you know, he comes into your home unannounced when you told him to stay away, he beats you. These are signs of abuse. If a man behaves that way, you are in danger. In real life, women who encounter and fall in love with men like that end up in battered women's shelters. They end up in cemeteries. I mean, this is life and death, and it's not a joke. It's not a romance. It's not a sweet story, and yet it's being sold that way. So it was very, very dangerous. And what we found in protesting it, we did protests across the country, stoppatriarchy.org, and people with the revolution clubs in California, in New York, in different parts of the country, Seattle. We went out to the theaters, and a lot of people really appreciated what we were doing, people who were just passing by. We got so many thanks and so many hugs, including people who, you know, in New York, you get a lot of foot traffic. The people who work in domestic abuse shelters, people who are lawyers for trafficking victims, a lot of people who were just passing through, they stopped us, they hugged us, people joined the protest. But then there were people who were going to the theater, and a lot of them either, you know, they kind of scurried past us to not talk to us and not take our flyer. But some of them took it, and we hope that they will think about what they saw and what they read. And I'm sure many of them will, because the movie was quite disturbing. I know when I went to see it, a lot of the people in the theater were pretty shook up by it, even though they weren't ready to condemn it. And I think if they had a flyer in their hand to walk them through it, it would have been helpful for them to make sense of what they saw. But then you have, like you said, you have the people who say, who are you to tell us what we should be turned on by? Who are you to say that we should not enjoy it? It's just a fantasy, or it's a love story, or this is fine because she consents. And that's very dangerous. And I think the biggest thing that we had to argue with people is stop thinking about just the individual. Besides the fact that it's a horrible story for the individual in it, besides the fact that it's abusive, think what it says about society and what it reinforces in society for this message to be pumped out with multi-million-dollar promotion in thousands of theaters across the country and mainstreaming this. You have to think about, no one has the right to enjoy and get off on and be titillated by and play with and claim empowerment through the sexualized abuse of women, even if they say, oh, but I like it. Nobody gets that right outside of a world that actually gives rise to that fantasy. And that real world is a world that really does treat women like garbage. It really is a world that trains millions and millions of men and women, which this film is part of, to get off on the sexualized abuse of women.
Exactly.
And so this is a piece of propaganda, and it should be recognized for its social role.
Exactly. I want to remind people that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sansara Taylor, a writer for Revolution Newspaper and from StopPatriarchy.org. Now let's jump into it. We've got about 4.5 minutes left. Let's jump into this, because I do want to trip out a little bit about how could this be different?
Oh, man. You know, you have to just imagine if people were not propagandized from the very early age in the music and the culture and the films and the pornography industry and the ways that women's bodies are used to sell everything. If we weren't weighed down by the constant propagation of misogynist patriarchal scripture and the total suffocation and silencing of real scientific education of women's bodies, of sexuality, of reproduction, If we actually had a society that wasn't so bombarded by both the culture and the structures that enforce this patriarchy, and we had state power, we had made a revolution, and we'd implemented what RevCom.us has available, the new constitution for the Socialist Republic of North America. We'd succeeded in making a revolution, and we brought into being a new society that was where we were casting off all this heavy chains that weigh on people and bringing into being a culture and an education system that celebrated women's full humanity together and their equality with men, and that challenged all forms of, you know, sort of the patriarchal, oppressive gender norms and sexuality, the bigotry against LGBT people, all of this. And this was part of a culture that's relating to the world and the planet and to oppressed peoples and different nationalities in a whole different way, celebrating that diversity. We could really live in a world where never again does a woman have to fear walking down the street at night or looking any man in the eye without fear, you know, where girl children are not, from the moment they're born, treated like they're weaker, less smart, cute, they have to wear pink. Everybody, I mean, starting from the earliest age, people, even if they don't mean to, there's studies, they start to talk, as soon as they know a baby's a girl, they talk in a higher pitched voice and they talk sillier talk, you know, than they do to a boy baby. Imagine that babies were treated like humans. Imagine that people were treated like humans. Women were treated like humans. And there wasn't a major distinction. I think all of that is quite possible. It'd be incredibly liberatory. There'd be great diversity. There'd be a lot of space for difference. But they would be based on people's full humanity. And that is possible. And that's both why we need to step out and fight and build up, fight the power and transform the people for revolution today. And it's the kind of culture we need to foster within this movement right now. We need to live that morality. We need to project it. And this is a big part of changing ourselves in the course of changing the world.
That's great, Sansara. It's really uplifting and inspiring. And I think not just for me, but for everybody who's hearing this. Now, just a few more things. Tell people where they can find out more about all this.
Yes, you can go to revcom.us. which stands for Revolutionary Communist, RevCom, RevCom.us, which is the website of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And if you go there, there's a segment called Fight the Power and Transform the People for Revolution, which if you find that, then you can find the whole listing of events and protests planned for International Women's Day. There are plans in Los Angeles, Seattle, San Francisco, New York, Chicago, Cleveland, and I expect there'll be more posted in the coming days. And there's materials that you can learn more, why this is not human nature, how this can change, the kind of revolution that's needed, the new thinking on that that's been developed and advanced by Bob Avakian and is being fought for by the Revolutionary Communist Party and this whole broader movement. And so all that you can find at revcom.us. You can also go to stoppatriarchy.org and connect in that way. And that's what I would say.
All right, Sansara Taylor, thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay, thanks, Michael.
Sure.
Take care.
You too. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Sansara Taylor from Revolution Newspaper and StopPatriarchy.org, and we've been talking about International Women's Day and the tremendous need for women, men, and everyone to stand up and fight against women's oppression, not just on International Women's Day, but all the time. All right. And to finish this up, I'd like to read something from Bob Avakian from his book Basics. And it's the third chapter and the 22nd verse in there. You cannot break all the chains except one. You cannot say you want to be free of exploitation and oppression, except you want to keep the oppression of women by men. You can't say you want to liberate humanity, yet keep one half of the people enslaved to the other half. The oppression of women is completely bound up with the division of society into masters and slaves, exploiters and exploited. And the ending of all such conditions is impossible without the complete liberation of women. All this is why women have a tremendous role to play, not only in making revolution, but in making sure there is all the way revolution. The fury of women can and must be fully unleashed as a mighty force for proletarian revolution. Again, that's from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and his book, Basics, all right? Go to RevCom.us and look for the book, Basics, and you can actually get an ebook there as well. All right, that brings us to the end of yet another show. I'm the host and producer of The Michael Slate Show, and I want to thank all of my guests today, Gareth Porter and Sansara Taylor. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my engineer for today, Federico Garcia. And I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And if you want to follow me, you can on Facebook and Twitter. We're going to go out now with just a little bit more of Leslie Gore's song, You Don't Own Me, because I think it just has so much heart. And again, it's a good way to remember. So here it is, Leslie Gore with a little bit more of You Don't Own Me. Talk to you again next week.